And what we are doing here for any newcomers is going over original dictation information that's newly presented by Doug Thompson. And I have a position here with Doug to help him, which I'm thrilled to be able to do. It's such a learning and growth experience for me. And it's any way that I can help in the unfolding of our dream, I feel such an honor and blessing to be able to do so. So it feeds me in much ways. And so we are reading through what's called the original dictation, which is the notes what Doug has compiled of the original dictation from Helen, and fit in with the one of the earliest written versions that is available called the Urtext. So those two are fit together. And we are going through this as I read, and Doug does commentary, and people are invited for some discussion and information. And practical add-ins is so valuable with this information to point to how it actually happens in our lives. It helps. I find it. You're back. I'm relaxed a minute. I'm going to hold the mic, Doug. The practical applications of showing how this works very practically in our lives, I find highly useful. I like to share that of my own life, and it triggers in people's minds of, oh yeah, that's how it brings up, it'll immediately bring to surface of how that may thread through their own life, and you have not made the connection before in connection with the material that is being presented or what they have read, and nicely fits everything together. I think it's very important, and we all can have a different relationship with it. It can come in different forms and images and different things that are said or heard, feelings, different interactions in our life. So, Doug, I guess that's ready to hand over to you. Are you still here and listening and unpanted? Because I'm going to release the mic, and if you're not, I'll take it back again. Okay, here you go. Thanks.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and sorry about this kerfuffled discombobulation here between trying to get a new computer installed, which has been in and out of the house, I think, four times this week with going back to the dealer with problems, and having difficulty getting onto Pal Talk. At 4 o'clock, I was not really quite ready yet. I gather a lot of people have been having trouble getting into Pal Talk, seen from some of the comments. In any event, we are here, and yes, Deborah's introduction was very good. What we're going to be doing is reading from the Urtext, which is the earliest typed copy of the course, in a version I prepared that includes material from the original earlier shorthand notes that was omitted from the Urtext, so that we can see, in essence, the whole of what Helen originally received in the order in which she received it, insofar as we can determine what that order is. And we left off last week, I believe, at T1B30A, and Deborah's put the link up. I'm going to pop it up again for anybody who missed it. And for those on the radio, except the radio's not working, is it? If anybody is actually listening and can't see the screen, if you go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74 and then click on the original dictation, and you'll get to the online version or the online copy. And to the main section headings, you'll see that I've included both the section headings used in the HL, section headings used in the foundation version to help people line it up, and numbered each paragraph. And the paragraph numbers are what we're going to be using mostly. And if you want to find your place or a particular place from a paragraph reference in the HTML copy, just use Control F. In most browsers, that's the search button, and type in the paragraph reference. So if I say, for instance, I'm going to start at T1B30A, that would be type T space 1 space B space 30A. And that will take you right to that paragraph. And for the most part, you can ignore the T1 because, well, as long as we're in chapter 1, the latter part of the reference is all the search tool needs to find it. All right. The link is clickable. So, Deborah, if I got my place right, we can start the reading there at Miracle Principle 30, as the Ur text numbers them. Last week we concluded a discussion of 29. We concluded with a discussion of 29. And the idea that forgiveness, it is the privilege of the forgiven to forgive. And the forgiven are the means of atonement, atonement being undoing. And those released by Christ must join in releasing their brothers, for this is the plan of the atonement. That's 29. And so with number 30 to begin, at this point, since I didn't go through my normal intro and cover sort of a checklist, if there's any questions that anybody has that you want to ask before we start, stick your hand up. This would be a good time. If not, Deborah, I'll give you the mic to give what you have received in order to keep it, Carmen is typing on the board. Yeah, that is a very, 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 very important point that the Course stresses, and the ego world, of course, to keep something, you have to prevent people from getting at it. But in reality, in God's world, to keep something, you have to give it away. Kind of exactly the opposite. All right, here's the mic tip.
Thanks, Doug. Okay, I'm going to begin here reading at T1B30A. Miracles are the way in which minds that serve the Spirit unite with Christ for the salvation, in parentheses, or release, of all God's creations. Aside, parentheses, Helen Schuckman commented on awakening with the phrase, God is not mocked, with anticipation of punishment, close parentheses. Interpretation, God is not mocked, was intended as reassurance. You are afraid that what you wrote last night was contradictory, conflicting with some earlier points, especially because you are writing while you are all doped up. Remember, God is not mocked under any circumstances. Contradictions, Doug, here's the mic.
Okay. All right, you were just starting there on paragraph D. All right. There are several interesting things going on here. First of all, note that what Helen is writing down alternates here between what she's hearing, which is the dictation of the miracle principles, and her own essential diary entries, essentially indicating how she's thinking and feeling about it. So there's an aside here that she awoke with that phrase in her mind, talking about God is not mocked with the anticipation of punishment. And then, as she says that, we have a conversation between Jesus and Helen, because he responds with, God is not mocked, was intended as reassurance. You are afraid that what night was contradictory. So Helen is being directly addressed here, conflicting with some earlier points, especially because you were writing while you were all doped up. This also tells us a little bit about what's going on with Helen. I believe at that point, I think that incident is described in Absence from Felicity. I haven't looked at it in some years, but as I recall, that was the source, and there's a discussion of Helen having, I don't know, the flu or something, and taking some medication which was making it difficult for her to concentrate. And the next paragraph, which Deborah's going to read next, is one, I think, of the most important of the missing pieces in terms of explaining the relationship between Jesus and Helen, the relationship between the author and the scribe, those functions, and the significance and precision of the particular words being used. Whose words are these? Are they those of the author or those of the scribe? And in this paragraph, we're going to find out. Here's the mic, Deb.
T1B30D. Contradictions in my word mean lack of understanding or scribal failures, which I make every effort to correct, but they are still not crucial. The Bible has the same problem, I assure you, and it's still being edited. Consider the power of my word in that it has withstood all the attacks of error and is the source of truth. 30E, in parentheses, the whole 30E. Tell Bill that there are certain advantages in being a psychologist. Doug, I can stop right here. Would you rather me leave this paragraph? I think so. Here's the mic.
Yeah, thanks. I didn't get my hand up there quick enough to give you an alert. All right, I'm going to read that paragraph again because I think it is one of three or four paragraphs that are very significant in terms of the author's own statements about what's going on here and how Helen, and the relationship between Helen and the voice at this point. So Jesus is speaking, contradictions in my word mean lack of understanding. This is pertaining to Helen's, the fear she expressed two paragraphs above, that maybe she was getting it down wrong because she perceived some contradictions. So Jesus is telling her and the rest of us, contradictions in my word mean either a lack of understanding, you don't understand the words, so they appear to you contradictory even though they're not, or scribal failures. You maybe got the wrong words down. The latter, the scribal failures, he says, I make every effort to correct. And elsewhere, he expands on the nature of that effort to correct. But then he points out that they're still not crucial. The Bible has the same problem, scribal failures, errors. But that the power of my word, in capitals, emphasized, and this would be Jesus' word, he says to Helen, consider the power of my word in that it has withstood all the attacks of error and is the source of truth. So, elsewhere he says that every word is meaningful. And here he's saying, but errors are not crucial. And those two ideas, I think, are very, very significant in terms of how important are the words and differences and potential mistakes. Every word is meaningful, so it's worthwhile trying to get them right, but mistakes are not crucial. And how I understand the rest of this statement about the surviving the attacks of error is that the voice of the Holy Spirit is there for all of us at any time to undo any mistakes in terms of our own understanding. Because I think, as everyone knows, in terms of the way human perception works, having the right words in the right order is only half the task of making an effective communication. Because you can get 10 people reading one sentence and walking away with 12 different understandings of what that sentence meant. Projection makes perception. So what we bring to our reading is what we're going to walk away from our reading from. And if we bring to our reading a prayerful, reverent approach with an openness to the Holy Spirit, our perceptions will emerge correctly, even if the words are wrong. That's how I'm understanding what's being said here. And I think that that's really important. Because we are learning here, we're being told here that Jesus has in fact dictated every word. Helen's not just making it up. But that there's going to be some mistakes because Helen does not always get the word right for one reason or another. And we've already run into some dictated corrections and we'll run into some more yet. And that is basically the end of that topic. And we're back into projection and possession discussion in 30E. Oh, here you go, Deb. Oh, yeah.
Hey, Carmen, go ahead with the mic.
Hi, sweethearts. Can you hear me? Any feedback? Can anybody hear me? Yes. Oh, thank you. Since you're at a stopping point and you stopped to emphasize that this paragraph really, really owns the dictation by Jesus, I wanted to put this out there because it causes some confusion among some people. There's a rumor circulating that the entire section on sex that's in the urtext was Helen's opinion and didn't come from Jesus. And I was presented with it was a secondhand receipt. I got this from Ian Patrick in England, and he said that he was told that the entire section on sex was Helen's opinion, and the proof of that was that it was so similar to Catholic theology that we were to just dismiss all of the stuff that was written on sex. And I thought about it, and I took it into prayer, and I responded to him by email, and I said, Ian, if that's the case, then Helen's one of the most introspective and objective human beings ever, because she's the object of so many of the examples that Jesus uses about sex. So it's like, you know, and he said, well, he would have to pray about it too. But I just wanted to bring that up, that that's been out there, and for people who might be confused, I really have personally come to believe that that's not the case, but just to offer that where Helen makes some statements, she notes that those are her statements. So when it's said that a lot of the urtext is Helen's writing and doesn't have Jesus's authority, I would like for people to prayerfully take that to the Holy Spirit and ask, did Helen honestly note all of her asides and her personal notes and, you know, clearly distinguish them from Jesus, or was she slipping her opinion in? And I think that's for each of us to decide for ourselves with the Holy Spirit's help. But for me, I really think she was very honest about it, like you point out, and noted where she was having these little sides. So thank you for giving me the time, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Carmen. And I appreciate your bringing that point up. Actually, I've seen a letter written by Ken, and I forget who sent me a copy. Was an individual who had asked Ken about just that in terms of the material on sex and possession that was taken out. I have it here somewhere, but it's not handy. And Ken writes, and I believe he's stated elsewhere, this isn't in a private confidential conversation, he's quite open about sharing his viewpoint on this. He says that, yeah, it's Helen's ideas about sex, it's not Jesus, that the sex material is homophobic, and certainly we wouldn't expect Jesus to be homophobic, but Helen, he thought, was, yet she was working and best friends with a gay man. How could she be homophobic? And, yeah. One of the reasons I'm putting this material together and making it available is that without having it, without being able to look at it for yourself, it's able to evaluate opinions such as that made by people who presumably know what they're talking about and have looked at the material. You can take their opinion or you can look at the material yourself and evaluate it. Until recently, it's been extraordinarily difficult to actually see the material in question. But you're really right, Carmen. A great deal of the sex material is specifically addressed to Bill or Helen about their particular phobias or issues or difficulties. And there's clearly two different voices, that of Jesus and that of Helen. And even where Helen doesn't label it, where her writing is sort of continuous in terms of the conversation, it's very obvious which voice is which. And so I think what Ken is getting at there is that Helen pulled that information out of her own unconscious, and it wasn't really the voice, the author of it. And then your comment would be completely appropriate, that she's got to be the most objective human being that's ever walked the face of the earth, because it is so directed towards her own healing and identifying her own issues. Now, I was going to say something else. I was thinking something else when you were talking, and I forget what it was on that question. But the teaching on sex being similar to Catholic theology, only if you take, edit it. Only if you edit a few comments like the only valid use of sex is procreation, and equate that to the Vatican's position on birth control and contraception, for instance, could you conclude that what Jesus is saying in this material, or what's written on the page, if we leave the question of authorship out for a moment, is the same as the Vatican's position? As soon as you follow the use of the word validity and recognize it's being used in a scientific context through that whole section, you see that what's being said is anything but the Vatican's position on sex, or it doesn't talk. It's not a discussion of contraception at all. It's not. And I think that the first line of paragraph 30D is really relevant there, about lack of understanding. That if them approached without very careful understanding, you may in fact perceive things being said that are not being said at all. And as far as Helen's own ideas and interpretations being part of the material, in the shorthand notes in the air text, we see some of her commentary. She's writing her opinion. By the time we get to the Foundation version, we find that a great deal of material is simply gone. And that was her opinion. In her opinion, all the stuff on sex didn't belong. We see a great deal of material that survives being reworded, so then quite different than it originally said. And who did that? Well, Helen did that. And sometimes she had help from Ken, and by all indications, Bill was not involved in that rewriting process. In fact, was quite opposed to it. That's how Helen reported it, anyways. So the Helenisms, or the influence of Helen on the dictation, increases with each subsequent version, which reflects her opinion on what it should say than what she originally heard and wrote. So that idea that the urtext or the notes suffers from Helen's own subjectivity in a way that was removed in later versions is exactly the opposite to what I have observed in hundreds of specific instances where I've examined how paragraphs changed over the years, how particular paragraphs changed over the years. That we get more and more and more of Helen's influence as she reworked, rewrote, restructured the material in subsequent editings. And in the earliest material, her input is very clearly identifiable and distinct from what the voice is saying in the conversations between the two. So yeah, in terms of Helen's pipe being rusty, I mean, there's something valid about that observation, in that in the beginning, and at right around now, in this very early first chapter of the book, it was a new experience for her. The pattern the smooth dictation that began to occur later without interruptions, without conversations, had not yet been established. So you get these breaks where Helen's raising questions and Jesus stops to answer them. Or Bill is raising questions that Helen is writing about. And we get these numerous tell Bill this or that or the other thing, which is in response to a question that Bill has introduced, you know, in response to what he's read to date. So these conversations are going back and forth. That's in a sense rusty pipes. I mean, there is the method of her dictation did change over time and became smoother and less subject to certain kinds of interruptions. But after it was written down, long after it was written down, it started to change. And going back and reading what she dictated 5 or 8 years earlier and changing it. And that's a bit like, you know, I think of a court case where you have a car accident and witnesses are saying who did what. And you've got the policeman's report of, well, she told me this 2 minutes after the crash. And now, 2 years later, she's saying something different. Which one are you most likely to believe? She's going to remember what she actually heard within 5 minutes of having heard it more reliably than she's going to remember 8 years later, in my view, in terms of the probability of validity or accuracy of the memory. So what we're getting is not her thinking, oh, I remembered that wrong, or, oh, I remember having made a mistake 8 years ago. It's her looking at it and saying, I think that should be different, and making it different. And there's always the possibility that she could have been asking if there's any corrections needed, and Jesus could be telling her, even 8 years later, yes, such and so, I want changed. But there is no indication that that's what's going on in any particular example I've looked at, with a couple of extremely minor maybes, uncertainties. The vast majority of the changes that got made in later years, in later versions, are Helen's taking very direct, clear statements and making them vague and ambiguous and muddy, so they can be read in all kinds of different ways, taking the edge and clarity and precision of the original wording and making it literally more palatable, and therefore more subject to confusion or misinterpretation. Not that the entire idea is lost, but that it's mixed in with other things and blunted so that the power of Jesus' original communication is reduced. So in summary then, I'm going on a long time about this, that whole idea that the earlier versions have more of Helen and the later versions that got edited out is exactly the opposite to what I've observed in comparing a few hundred examples of the editing. That in fact, what we see in the earliest material bears a great deal of evidence of being far more valid and directly what Jesus meant with precision than substantially changed versions of the same passage made 5 or 8 years later, where Helen's fears of the material or disagreement with the material is leading it to be substantially modified so that the original clarity is lost. In the dictation, the way it's very clear as you look at the notes, the way the material was dictated, and Helen's report of the dictation confirms this, that the material was coming to her so quickly, she didn't have time to edit it. She would get afraid of certain words and not write them down or write them down wrong in a moment, but there wasn't a lot of room in that process of taking down what she's hearing for her to introduce her own thoughts and feelings about what's going on. Years later, as she sat down and looked at the paragraph with an editor's pencil and reworded it and restructured it, there's lots of room for her interpretation of the myth reflected rather than what the author initially directly said. So, yes, that's an important point, Carmen, and I thank you for raising it. And I just probably said way more than I needed to say on that one, but it is an important question. And the only way anybody's ever going to be able to unscramble the different opinions being expressed about that is by actually looking at the material for themselves. And as Carmen mentioned, do that prayerfully with an openness to the Holy Spirit and look at the evidence. And the evidence all supports the notion that the original rendition is far closer to the author's intent than later edited forms, except where there are dictated corrections, where he says, go back and change this to that. And sometimes we can read those instructions and note that in later versions, they didn't. They didn't change it. All right, I'm going to give the mic back to Deborah here.
Okay, in this next paragraph, this stuff is so exciting for me. I get so excited and just swirl inside with what's being presented about projection. So T1B 30E, the whole paragraph is in30E is in parentheses. Tell Bill that there are certain advantages in being a psychologist. A major one is the understanding of projection and the extent of its results. Possession is very closely related to projection. Lucifer could be literally translated light bearer. He literally projected himself from heaven. Projection still has this hurling connotation, because hurling something you do not want and regard as dangerous and frightening to someone else. This is the opposite of the golden rule. And having placed this rule upside down, the reverse of miracles, or projection, follows automatically. Doug, do you want this? Here you go.
This is another one of those paragraphs about which one could sit down and write a PhD thesis on this paragraph alone. There are so many ideas being linked together in it. Projection and perception, or possession rather, possession and projection are being linked here. And the idea of Lucifer is introduced. And the name, I believe, actually does mean literally light bearer. And in the biblical mythology, the fallen angel, Lucifer, projected or hurled himself from heaven. And this hurling connotation is being associated with projection. So I think most of us are probably familiar enough with the course to have some sense of what projection means. Is I take something, it's defined right here, something I do not want and regard as dangerous and frightening, and I project or hurl or pin it on someone else. Any judgment of guilt made by the ego is just that projection. Is what I find unacceptable in others is what I have found so unacceptable and frightening in myself that I refuse to even acknowledge it's there. So I put it outside, or where my ego can think it's outside, so I don't have to deal with it, or so I can attack myself without actually seeming to attack myself. I can attack myself through the proxy, my brother, by attaching to him what is true about me. And that's what's going on there. I'm looking at the next paragraph, which in the online version I have highlighted, and I don't know why I highlighted it. Maybe by the time we get to the end of it, I will have remembered that when there's a highlight, that's usually an indication that I see something I suspect might be an error that I need to check, but I don't have time to check it at the moment, so I highlight it to remind me to do that later. And that could be what's going on here. I don't know. Carmen writes, projection equals we hurl our mental toxins outward. Yeah, that is, rather than looking for healing within, where the issue originates in my own thought, the issue is made to appear to sit outside me in someone else's body, where it can be hidden, fought, fled, fracked, and essentially completely misperceived. It's a way of building a barriers against recognizing what needs to be healed and undertaking the necessary activity of healing it. Okay, Deborah, here's the mic.
I have a question in here, and I also have a comment to make. So I'm going to put the question forth first and hand you the mic, or anybody that can articulate this for me, if I'm on any track at all that is in line with what this paragraph is saying. I'm wondering what possession and possessiveness, if they're linked in this word the way it's being used here, because there seems to be a lot of possessiveness that goes on with human beings. And how much with projection that's all tied in, which it has to be somehow, but and with that word possession. So does this make any sense? Can anything be articulated and cleared for me in my mind? Do you see any confusion? Here you go.
Yeah, the theme of possession really is a significant one, and it's the way it's presented in this material in several different segments, it can be difficult to track just what's being said, and it's being talked about in two ways. The first kind of possession being discussed is possessed by demons. You'll recall in previous weeks we've read material about demon possession, and Jesus is saying that the demonic in this sense is really our own earthbound thoughts. And in the absence of holiness or communication with the Holy Spirit, emptiness, earthbound thoughts occupy that empty space in the mind, and one can in that sense be possessed, but it's not an alien external entity possessing. It's our own unhealed earthbound thoughts. And possession is also discussed in the concept of ownership and control, the desire to possess another, and that is related to sexuality as well. And in that sense, it at several points later in the course, the idea comes up in the context of ownership, and we're told that ownership is a very risky, dangerous thing. And possession is very closely related to projection. I don't fully understand what that sentence means in this context. So I have a bit of a question here myself, and I would need to spend some time looking at other instances of those words to see just what relationship Jesus is trying to draw our attention to between possession and projection. But I think that this would be the possession, the ownership kind of possession. In projecting guilt, for instance, we literally hurl our guilt onto another. In trying to possess another, we literally hurl our control, like throwing a net, to control and confine another, and impose our will on something or someone that is perceived as external to ourselves. So to that extent, both ownership and projection involve a kind of hurling or extending or moving conceptually our own thoughts and laying them on top of or attaching them to something or someone perceived as external. Okay. Deborah, here you go.
Carmen, here's the mic. I welcome your comments.
Hi, sweeties. I'm not sure about the possession of other people or possessions of things, but about possession in the sense of, like, demonic possession or whatever. Bill seemed to have had kind of an interest in the idea of possession, and Jesus talks to him in the air text pretty extensively about his relationship with his father in particular, that Bill's reactions to his father, he blamed on his father. There's kind of the devil made me do that kind of feeling to it. Growing up Catholic, I heard a lot of stories about possession, and they tended to be about violence. Women say that they're God told them to kill their children or whatever. There's this idea that serial killers or psychopaths are possessed by demons. Their own violent tendencies are blamed on some other entity. And, you know, from my own personal experience, I can't tell you how long I blamed all of the problems in my life on my mother's negative talk. And, you know, that there was that one line in the course that says that you can't be cursed by another unless you already have accepted that about yourself. And it really brings that back to owning, you know, all of these negative thoughts and compulsions and urges, where when I was growing up, it was believed that some external force was giving you these thoughts and that you really weren't in control. And so your actions, in whether it's sexual or violence or combinations, could be blamed on somebody else. And it's sort of like, you know, the devil made me do it defense. And that's all pure projection. And that's how I understand that section. Thank you.
I think that's a really interesting and valid point, Carmen. The topic of possession is a huge one, and I don't feel brushed up on it enough to say a whole lot more than has been said already. But it's worth noting, as you did, that Bill had some interest in that topic. Some of the New Testament passages about Jesus dealing with demon possession in the Gospels are referred to. And certainly in the first century Palestine, illness and psychological disorders were generally understood language of demon possession. And, you know, today we catch a bug, right? We have bacteria or viruses infecting us. In those days, it was evil spirits. That's how such things were understood. And Bill's relationship with his father, the idea that dad made me do it, is very much related. And I think in most people's experience, we tend to attribute responsibility in the wrong place. We tend to not take responsibility for our own choices and not even believe we have choices, that we believe we have to behave in a certain way because of the way others have behaved in the past, that they're somehow in control of our behavior. And your example, Carmen, about your mother having been negative leaves you with no choice but to be negative yourself, for instance, which, of course, is how it's experienced, but, of course, it's not true. the bug is a projection, too. It very likely is. It very likely doesn't have a whole lot of difference at the core to the idea of demons. Something out there, other than our own minds and our own choices, is being given responsibility. Bill believed his negative attitude was his father's fault, Carmen writes. And yes, there's quite a bit in the Ur text that supports that idea. And Jesus is trying to help him understand that even though that may have been the origin in his relationship with his father, the choice to continue it today isn't his father's, it's Bill's. And Bill finally did get that point. Okay, Deborah, now I'm not sure if I answered your question or if Carmen answered your question, so I'm going to give you back the mic. You said you wanted to comment as well.
Yeah, your answers were loaded for me. They kept what you were saying kept bringing little pieces of thought to mind, jumping around. So I'm going to listen to the tape. Hopefully this tape's okay because I want to listen to it later, especially listening to this part to unravel my thoughts on it. And yeah, Cynthia, don't we all believe that our parents messed us up? It seems to be a general theme for us as humans, and I very much put all of that responsibility on my parents at one point and was furious with them until I realized, my God, what kind of script am I writing for them? Why can't I just recognize them for who they are and allow them to be that and take it from there, which I very much was able to do. So I released my script, and they're who they are. That's it. No judgment. That's who they are. Realize that what comes up for me in it is my stuff to go through, my projection. What I wanted to comment was on, I'm well aware of since childhood, I've been on this training path of being, of working in the healing capacity. So I, Course in Miracles is just amazing for me, as I'm sure it is for so many and everyone that is delving into it as a student. So what comes up for me in this projection thing is if we don't realize exactly what we are doing when we are projecting, it's really real of an energetic force that we are hurling out towards someone else. And so it is very much our responsibility to seek for healing that inside ourselves so that we are not projecting out and hurling that energy, that poison. It's a poisonous, it's an energetic poison that we are literally healing out towards someone else. So in the learning of this, I've been tangled in it for many years of feeling that coming toward me, seeing how I'm affecting others when it's leaving me. And as it's coming toward me, then it would attach on parts of me that were likening whatever was coming toward me so that I would be sick for 2 or 3 days following working with someone in a healing capacity. And now it's finally got to the point now where recently I've seen poison and felt it being hurled from someone toward me. And as it's entered my system, I've been well aware of how it very much works within me and was allowing myself to be in that place as I usually go to allow it to move through me and allow myself to be that tool to be used in that healing force, used by Holy Spirit, used by my source. And I generally go there, but have never been able to just release it. It's always attached to something, and there I go down again. But this time, it went through me, and it was fantastic because I could feel, I mean, there was no judgment at all on the person, and I could feel that this was healing as it's passing through energy and it's just leaving. And so for me, that is the gift that I am called upon to give. One of the gifts I am called upon to give is to help that person on that level so that a certain amount of what they are hurling out there or whatever, I'm able to cleanse with Holy Spirit cleanse through my assistance, is being received and purified through me, then they can allow the next to come up and or have that space that it able to go inside and see more clearly, or in effect, it's like the receptacle. You can pour something off, and then you've got room to see more clearly inside yourself. And I'm sure we all have that experience, especially in our thought system. So I will go on reading, unless that triggers anything for anybody else to give comment to or share with. Doug, here you go.
Oh, thanks. What's been occurring to me as you were speaking there is the relationship between what we've been discussing and forgiveness. For instance, dealing with toxins from another, whether it's a parent, a friend, a client, anyone whose negativity, for instance, we feel affected by, is a form of grievance. And we are attributing our experience of negativity or our unhappiness to someone else's behavior. And in the basic structure of forgiveness as laid out in the course, we're told that it's a misperception to believe that someone else's behavior is the cause of our emotional states. And we are, in a sense, in a prison created by ourselves that we imagine to be imposed by another. So the person against whom we have a grievance appears to us to be the prison guard, keeping us unhappy, leaving us unfree and unjoyful. So we're mad at him. In the process of forgiveness, we release that bondage, that possessiveness of the other's responsibility. We give it back to the person, and we release ourselves from the influence, the emotional influence of that person's behavior. And in that process, both parties are actually released from the mental toxin of grievance or blame or shame or guilt projection. Because grievances are essentially something that we project onto someone else. You're bad because you did X. That's my grievance with you. And I need to make you change. Bang, bang, bang. The opposite of that would be forgiveness. Okay, you did X. Whether I like it or not is really quite immaterial. It doesn't control my state of mind, at which point there's no hooks between the two people involved. And what the course goes on to say elsewhere, that is perhaps one of the most important things to understand about forgiveness and the course's whole thought system overall, is that my emotional state only appears to be a response to your behavior. In fact, my emotional state probably causes your behavior if it's bugging me. And as soon as I release you from my projections of shame and blame, all that negative energy or negative emotion that I'm sending towards you stops, and your response of doing something that pisses me off will stop too. And that very frequently happens in the experience of people who do forgiveness on significant issues, that when they can finally get over blaming somebody else for their bad behavior, quote unquote, bad behavior, even without any communication with that other person, it is very frequently the case that people report suddenly the bad behavior stopped. That what was actually causing it at a subliminal level, what was causing the other person to behave badly towards me was the fact that and as soon as it stopped bugging me, there was no longer any energy in it or motive for that behavior, and it simply ceased. And the reversal of cause and effect, that's what I'm talking about here, which is a major theme in the course. It's not mentioned very often, but it's mentioned crucially. And we'll be getting into that at some point. I'm not quite sure exactly where that is at the moment. I don't think we're going to run into it today. But we're going to be getting into some of the Casey stuff today. And I'm going to give you back the mic after reading Carmen's comment here that healing can actually end a relationship. It's us we're angry with, so if we see it right, that healing can actually end a relationship. Yeah, sometimes, I mean, there are relationships, there are marriages that are based on a war and two parties unconsciously agreeing to quarrel with each other over this, that, or the other thing. And if one of them simply stops and withdraws his investment in the quarrel, they sometimes find they have nothing to say to each other. It's just like there is no more relationship there because it was all about the war. It's almost like if you imagine a battlefield and one army just stops fighting. Well, there's no more fighting. And everybody's going to look around and say, well, what are we here for? It's like it's simply nothing left to do, no reason to engage with each other when the agenda is shifted from conflict or battles to what I would call in this case peace, a loving acceptance of the other and non-resistance to whatever the other is running about doing. Because that resistance, the disapproval, the grievance, the resistance felt by one person towards another can in fact be a major dynamic in a human relationship. And many relationships just are that, or are just that, combative, where two people get together to have a fight. And it's ritualized in the boxing ring, for instance, where two guys who might actually well be good friends outside the ring get in there and they play this game called Let's Fight. And the crowds cheer. But if you take the fight out, then what are they there for? It's like one boxer in a ring. What's he doing? What can he do? There's no one to fight with. End of fight. Okay. I'm going to drop the mic now, Deb.
Good stuff, Carmen and Doug there. Carmen, one thing before I read on was where you had posted, it's us we're angry with, though, if we see, right? And I wanted to, it just triggered for me because before I've had this real shift to that place of really letting things go through me. Recently was just prior to that, maybe a month prior to that, I came, no, but it was a little bit more than a month. It was during this wintertime. But it just so much came up for me that I'm going, oh, my, I'm so angry at me. I'm just so angry at me about this, about that. It's all this stuff just really surfaced about that anger, and then everything just kind of broke. So, I totally am with this. Here I'm going with T1B30F. The correction lies in accepting what is true in yourself by bringing all that you are into light. Parentheses. Helen Schuckman, fearful of writing next part, close parentheses. Casey was wrong about possession, and he was also wrong about hurting himself. One of the major problems with miracle workers is that they are so sure that what they are doing is right because they know it stems from love, that they do not pause to let me establish my limits. Doug, here you go.
I want to draw particular attention to that last line because it relates to a major repeated theme in the throughout the course, and that is the necessity of asking. Jesus tells Helen to ask. We've covered this in recent weeks a number of times, and we're going to continue covering it because the theme keeps coming up. And we have part of the explanation here. One of the major problems with miracle workers and other loving, caring people who really want to help others and whose intentions are very positive is that they are so sure that what they are doing is right because they know it stems from love that they do not pause to let me establish my limits. This relates to the idea about spontaneous miracles that came up earlier, that the miracle needs to come from the divine through me and not be my own idea, because when I start trying to do miracles according to my own judgments, then ego is in the way. And even though the intention might be entirely pure, the effect, if my judgment is running the show, is liable to be chaotic because I don't know enough to make a valid judgment. Whereas Jesus or the Holy Spirit is aware of everyone and everything and knows where the miracle is going to be beneficial, and is the only what we might call level of consciousness capable of making those decisions. My ego awareness of what I see with my eyes, simply not capable of judging appropriately what is really right, which is the ultimate reason to not judge anything as wrong, because we simply can't. We can't do it validly. We don't know what's right and wrong at the ego level. That can only be known at the spiritual level. And I'm just looking at this again. The correction lies in accepting what is true in yourself and bringing all that you are into light. And this relates to the whole idea about grievances and projecting our own guilt onto others. The correction of that problem lies in accepting what is true in yourself instead of trying to hide it by bringing all that you are into light. So basically, projection is a form of darkness. When I say or think or feel, you are guilty, you are bad, you are evil to anyone or anything, what I'm doing is turning out the lights on my own self-awareness and the potential, the possibility for bringing the darkness in me to the light, because I'm hiding what's in me in my brother. I take literally what I'm afraid of or uncomfortable with in myself and hide it in you so that I can avoid having it healed. Deborah, here's the mic.
Cynthia, where you say on the board here, suppose you don't get an answer, and then Carmen is silence is an answer. And the way I personally work with this is always, it's this handing over to this source to do the healing, because I know it's not me, but I am definitely being used as a tool. So if I'm handing this over, if someone asks me to work with them, I could really tangle myself in a real messed up knot if I'm standing there going, well, should I or shouldn't I? Is this right or is that not right? Am I getting an answer? Am I not getting an answer? So what I'll do, unless something clearly comes through as no, don't go there, and that has happened, so that I don't go there, what I do is just hand the healing over as per usual and take instructions and do the work that the person can relate to, that something's going on here because we're human and they need to connect with it somehow, as do I. And so they're doing that work and allowing the healing to go to be happening. I'm an observer, and because I'm leaving myself so open, I am instructed. It comes in clearly. Stop. When to stop. What to do. So it's that kind of a communication process is in effect. Then you don't have to worry about getting it or not. It'll come through. It will, really will. Open up is I think really key. So I should go back on reading here. Anybody else? I guess not. Okay. So T1B30G. We're reading. Doug, yes, there is. Here you go.
Oh, that was really great, Deborah. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you, Carmen, for typing what you typed there, for which I'm going to read it. Silence is an answer, or sometimes can be an answer, I suppose. Or you are making me do... peace is the test of truth, and doubt means don't, attributed to Oprah. And I think that there's this whole topic of ask Jesus, okay, but I can't pick up the phone and call up, you know, say, hey, Jesus, like, what should I do about this? And write down the instructions and then do them. No, it comes through at a level of our own consciousness with which we need to be in tune. So part of the whole thing about guidance and asking Jesus is simply self-knowledge and being willing and able to recognize what's going on in our own mind and not be clouded by things like fears and judgments, which prevent us from hearing the divine. Fear and judgment, negativity, grievance, fear, terror, these things are literally complete blocks to spiritual awareness, awareness of ourselves, what's really going on within us. They completely, fill our mind with noise and drown out the voice of the Holy Spirit. So the whole question of how do I hear from God is a huge, significant, and complicated one with that very simple core. We hear from God by tuning into ourselves, and we can sometimes feel it physically. We can sometimes feel it emotionally, like I'm feeling doubtful or anxious about something. Well, that means don't, basically. Or I'm feeling peaceful and entirely okay about a proposed decision or course of action. That's another way to tune into yourself and your own inner truth, which is the Holy Spirit. Other times we actually hear voices. A thought will suddenly pop into my head, and it's like, where did that come from? And sometimes I will try to dismiss it. Other times I will simply follow it and see where it goes. And not infrequently, by the end of the day, I will conclude that that was direct guidance, that I was being led by the Holy Spirit or by Jesus to do some particular thing that I had absolutely no idea that I was going to do when the day began. And part of that is also cultivating the habit of openness to Jesus. You know, we read, I think it was last week, Helen's difficulty in finally getting that miracle principle down that comes up with the instruction, if you will tell me what to do, I will to do only that. And if we set our will that way, if you will tell me what to do, I will to do only that, we create an open channel to hear because we have set our will to do only that. And even if we aren't consciously aware of what it is, we can find ourselves quite unconsciously doing what we're told. And frequently, such guidance doesn't come in terms of a list of instructions which we need to follow, but moment by moment, the words will come to us, the words that we need to say, whether or not when I'm driving down the road I should turn right or left. We'll just know. And for those of us with egos, that's very useful, because if we had the full instruction sheet, our ego would start interpreting it and trying to improve upon it and interfering with it. That whole question, how do we ask? I'm going to read the line again from 30F because it's sort of the core of this issue. One of the major problems with miracle workers is that they are so sure that what they're doing is right, because they know it stems from love, that they do not pause to let me establish my limits. So we need to pause and consult. And one thing I have started doing is just reciting that little admonition, if you will tell me what to do, I will to do only that. And that's a pause. That's a pause. And at that point, if Jesus is trying to establish limits, or if I'm setting out to do something he doesn't want me to, or has, a better idea to offer, I'm giving him the opportunity to take my hand and lead me in a different way in that instant. And Carmen writes, our job is to entangle our mind with spirit. Then we learn to distinguish the, quote, shepherd's voice, quote, a thought that is much wiser than my own. Yeah, the entire business of divine guidance is a whole being undertaking of joining with the spirit at all levels and being open and receptive. It's a bit like plugging in your radio and tuning it to the right frequency. Excuse me. You're not going to get the message until you do that. Here's the mic, Debbie.
Carmen, thanks for adding that in there. Our job to entangle our mind-spirit. It's more than just opening. It's entangling with spirit. It's that intention of what you're doing, opening your mind. And, Doug, I really love that, what you said. If ego had the instruction sheet, and I go with that is it gives us another world war. If the ego had the instruction sheet, wow. It's really amazing the way this information is sent to us. Really, really amazing. So I'm going to carry on reading here with T1B30G. What in parentheses Casey did came from me. He could not be induced to ask me each time whether I wanted him to perform this particular miracle. If he had, he would not have performed any miracles that could not get through constructively. Thus have saved himself unnecessary strain. He burned himself out with indiscriminate miracles, and to this extent did not fulfill his own full purpose, and was also subject to the scribal error I mentioned at the start. The disciples were also prone to this. You know what, it seems a helper here. What did I just read? The strain. Straining. If you're straining, then that seems to be key right there. And whether you're on or you're off, you're out of sync with what is being asked of you, or you're in sync. Here you go, Doug.
Well, I do think that notion of strain is very significant as one of the, along with peace or doubt, one of the sort of heavenly signposts that gives us an indication of whether or not we're on the right track. A very kind of obvious signpost. How do I feel? And if I'm feeling a lot of strain in what I'm doing, then ego is calling the shots, not the Holy Spirit. If the goal is God's, He will provide the means. And I don't need to strain. Elsewhere in the Course we read things about it being effortless and you need do nothing, which doesn't mean don't do anything, but you don't need to do from your ego any particular thing except open yourself, the truth, to your true self, to the Holy Spirit, which will give you the directions and the means and the energy and the peace to do anything that Jesus wants to do. When I first read this paragraph that Deborah just finished, there was a lights-on experience for me. Since I was a small kid sitting in Sunday school at church, I wondered why, even in the New Testament accounts, some people get healed and some people don't. I mean, Jesus did all these miracles of healing, but he didn't heal every sick person in Palestine. And so sort of what's going on there? And I guess as a six-year-old, I was thinking of the miracle worker Jesus as a kind of Superman in a white coat, you know, the physician who could heal everything with the snap of a fingers, a kind of a magical understanding. And I think that idea lingered with me for a very long time in terms of struggling with what are miracles, why times heal this person and not that person. In this paragraph, we're told that if Casey had asked, he would not have performed any miracles that could not get through constructively, and thus would have saved himself unnecessary strain. And what I understand in relation to the previous miracle principles we're being told here is that the point of the miracle is not to heal the sick body. That's simply an effect. The point of the miracle is to exchange love and advance all involved towards the atonement or undoing of the separation illusion. And sometimes healing the body can be a part of that. And other times healing the body might very well get in the way of that. That it's not about healing the body, but it's about healing the soul, in essence, or undoing the separation. And miracles are misunderstood if they're thought of basically as, you know, Superman in a white coat with a stethoscope, which, unfortunately, many people, including myself for many years, understood miracles to be. And if a miracle healing wasn't happening, it was like the doctor isn't hearing my cry for help and won't come when I call. But that's not what it's about at all. Anyway, that was a personal issue for me that this paragraph helped with. Deborah, here's the mic.
Oh, I became distracted. That was good stuff. And I also became distracted. God darn it. I thought I had something else to bring up here, but I'm going to carry on reading because it's left my mind. Carmen, here's the mic.
Just really fast, I don't want to take any of your time. It's also, I think, saying that Casey was just taking everybody who came to him for healing and not asking Jesus who could receive and who couldn't. And his ego saw himself as a healer, so he would keep pouring energy into people who weren't receiving the healing. And I've noticed that myself in some of the people that are in our classes, that, you know, that they say on a conscious level they really do want healing, but there is a huge resistance to them. And if you keep pouring your energy into, you know, given people, going against, you know, if you're listening to your ego and saying, you know, I'm just going to pound it into this person, you're not being helpful to the person, and you're not directing your energies in ways where it can be received. And I think constructively is a key word in that phrase. And that's where we got to keep checking in. We just got to keep checking in. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carmen. And yeah, that ego in association with Casey. Casey, well, I think about the emergency room at the hospital, for instance. They don't turn anybody away. You know, you go there, you're sick, they'll try to help you. It's not a miracle business. It's a human scientific enterprise. And I think Casey was running his operations in much the same way, that he would try to help everybody. at the same way the emergency room does, and not taking the miracle-minded approach of waiting to be told when and where and with whom age. And as a result, like many physicians in the emergency room, he worked very long hours and got all worn out, and ended up sometimes not being very helpful to anyone, including his own family, because he was so exhausted. So, Deborah, here is the mic.
Great info. Fantastic. Okay, carrying on at T1B30H. Right? Yes. The answer is never perform a miracle without asking me if you should. This spares you from exhaustion, and because you act under direct communication, the trance becomes unnecessary. Whoa. Because miracles are expressions of love, It does not follow that they will always be effective. I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately because I am the atonement. You have a role in the atonement, which I have to you. That's really amazing. That didn't ever stood out to me before, that the trance becomes unnecessary. Huh. Really. Cool. 30i. Remember, you already have a point about the involuntary nature of miracles. We also have established the fact that everything involuntary belongs under Christ's control, under yours. Under Christ's control, miracles replenish the doer as well as the receiver. Doug, here's the mic.
Well, once again, we have such a large amount of material here being said in so few words. I want to sort of slow down and let some of that sink in a bit. So I'm actually going to just go over this last two paragraphs. Never perform a miracle without asking me if you should. This spares you from exhaustion, repeating the previous point about strain. And then because you're acting under direct control, the trance becomes unnecessary. Now, Casey, in the way he worked, he would generally go into a trance to access the supernatural realm and emerge. And in the trance, he would speak and give people often health-related advice. And in that trance state, he also could diagnose various kinds of physical ailments that physicians couldn't diagnose. And he was right, literally miraculously right, so much of the time that a great deal of attention ended up being paid to his relatively unusual skill. Now, he's not the only sort of medical intuitive to have ever lived on Earth. I think of Carolyn Mace, who does something similar. And there are physicians who will call her up when they can't make a diagnosis and say, what's wrong with so-and-so? And Carolyn Mace can figure it out or know it intuitively. She calls it intuition. I would be inclined to call that divine communication. But she doesn't go into a trance to do it. And that's being called direct communication here. And then we have this interesting line that because miracles are expressions of love, it does not follow that they will always be effective. Okay, so sometimes miracles won't be effective. And then he says, I am the only one who can perform miracles indiscriminately because I am the atonement. And that in itself is just a huge idea. You have a role in the atonement that is, which he will dictate to you. Okay, once more, we're into this divine communication bit and guidance. Remember, you already have a point, an earlier point about miracles, about the involuntary nature of miracles. We also have established the fact that everything involuntary belongs under Christ's control, not under yours. Here again, the distinction is being made here between what I think at a consciousness level should be done. That would be my control. And it might be very benevolent. It might be very well-meaning. It might even be very loving, but it's not informed. Only in communication with the higher realm under Christ's control only Jesus knows what needs doing. I can't know. I have to get my instructions from upstairs. It's like I'm driving my car and my hands are turning the steering wheel and keeping me from running into people and things in other cars. But My hands don't know what to do with the steering wheel. Unless my brain is giving them good instructions, my hands are going to get into a lot of trouble. And in this sense, the metaphor Jesus uses at the beginning, you will see miracles through your hands through me, and with which he concludes gifts of God, that same idea. We are like the hands of God. In using the metaphor of the automobile driver whose hands turn the wheel, but the brain, the mind, has to make the decision, has to dictate to the hands which way to turn the wheel. The hands can't know that by themselves without that communication with the mind. So we as miracle workers can't know what miracles to do without that communication with the divine. We are the hands, not the brain, of the divine. Everything involuntary belongs under Christ's control, not under yours. Under Christ's control, miracles replenish the doer as well as the receiver. This relates to the previous point about miracles being an exchange of love, through which divine energy is received by both parties to the transaction. So everyone walks away uplifted, replenished, invigorated, not exhausted, not strained. Point. End of point. Okay. The next one gets even more interesting. Here you go, Deborah.
Yeah, I was wondering, how will we get through this? It's so fascinating. 30J. So T1B 30J. Possession really means not under Christ's control, thus making him, in parentheses, the mind with a question mark there, vulnerable to projection. The references to the earthbound entering bodies really refer to the taking over by their own earthbound thoughts. This is demon possession. After all, Lucifer fell, but he was still an angel. He is thus the symbol for man. Atonement is the knowledge that the belief that angels can fall is false. It is true that mind can create projections as well as miracles, but it's not true that projections are real. Any psychologist should understand this. This is what is meant by the truth shall set you free. Doug, here's the mic.
I had thought that we had read this one last week, but we didn't. And earlier I was referring to just this paragraph about the earthbound thoughts and the definition of possession here really meaning not under Christ's control, thus making him, at the mind level, vulnerable to projection. And here we have it, that when we're not under Christ's control, we're under ego control, and we're possessed by our earthbound thoughts, and therefore we don't know what to do, because at the ego level we can't really understand anything. I'm just reading this over again. I think maybe it's worth repeating because it's such a significant one. The references to the earthbound entering bodies really refer to the taking over by their own earthbound thoughts. This is demon possession. After all, Lucifer fell, but he was still an angel. He is thus the symbol for man. Now, that is a fascinating line. Lucifer is the single symbol for man. And specifically, I think, for man's earthbound thoughts. Having fallen to earth, the communication with the divine was lost. The hands that we are became separate from the mind to which we belong, and we're bound to earth rather than our true nature. Another way of talking about the ego. And you'll note that the word ego doesn't show up in the course until chapter 3. That concept is here being addressed with different kinds of terminology, such as earthbound thoughts or man, referring to what we'll later learn is man's ego, as opposed to man's true essence. And then atonement or undoing is the knowledge that the belief that angels can fall is false. Ah, so angels can't really fall. The belief that they can is false. And it's the belief that they can that causes us the problem, because we imagine as true that which is not. It is true that mind can create projections as well as mirrors, but it's not true that projections are therefore real. Projections are figments of our imagination that we believe are real, but actually aren't. And any psychologist should understand this. And this is what is meant by the truth shall set you free. The truth will undo the illusions, and you will therefore be free of misperception. Wow. Yeah, that's T1B30J, Teddy. Okay, Deborah, here is the mic.
Very nicely articulated in this paragraph, and I had to go back to it to actually get it, allow it to go back into my mind and come up with what we were talking about in the healing context. And here it is right here. It is true that mind can create projections as well as miracles, but it's not true that projections are real. So in that healing context, if somebody is hurling toward me, if I have the belief invested or the judgment on the what is healed, the belief invested somewhere inside me of what is being hurled, then that is going to become real to me. If I am freed from that in my own mind, I have cleared and been purified in my own mind of what is being hurled, I can see that and sense that from the person that they are healing in that area, or they have that belief attached. There's a belief attached in there that they're healing toward me, projecting toward me. And, I had this so clear. And then I'll just allow it to go through me. If I'm not reinforcing that with my own investment in that belief being real, or what is being hurled as being real, then it will be allowed to go through. In that healing context, it will be allowed to go through the facilitator, through the person that is being used in that moment with spirit to cleanse. I think that's clear that I have put forth there. Here you go, Doug.
Well, I got it. I would relate that to the idea about you cannot be cursed unless you have first cursed yourself, in the sense of believing that you're cursable or unworthy, then a curse can have an effect on your mind. And I think that's what you're talking about in terms of the projection of toxins with clients and whatnot. If you believe they're real, then to you, they will be. You will experience them precisely as real. And as something external having invaded or taken control of you or possessed you. But if you don't believe, since they're not, then they will have absolutely no effect. The belief is profoundly significant in the way human psychology works, in the way we as human mammalian entities operate. What we believe profoundly determines what we will experience. And the whole, that's what the Course is talking about. The illusions we create, the beliefs we create that make us unfree, and how to get those corrected so be free of the untrue beliefs we walk around with that result in our experiencing unhappiness. Yeah. Belief is supremely critical. Okay. Here is the mic.
Yeah, yeah, Doug, and I love how it comes out in different words for different people. This is fantastic. And also, it also is a portrayal that there are brothers here working with each other. It's my brother is not my projection. It's what I'm doing with what my brother is processing or doing or sharing is my projection. So that to me is the gift to see clearly, to be able to not wipe out what we're not to not wipe out. That's clear to boy. Oh man, tangle with myself. I'm gonna carry on reading here. 30K, we're into 30K. T1B 30K. Christ-controlled miracles are part of the atonement, but Christ's guidance is personal and leads to personal salvation. The impersonal nature of miracles is an essential ingredient because this enables me to control their distribution as I see fit. That's precisely right there, that personal nature. So the way that we can personally connect. Enough. 30L. Christ's guidance, on the other hand, leads to the highly personal experience of revelation. This is why it involves personal choice. A guide does not control by definition, but he does direct, leaving the following up to you. Lead into temptation means guide us out of our own errors. Note that the word is lead, not order. Doug.
Okay, this is, we're getting into the notion of the personal here. And this is a profoundly significant couple of paragraphs in terms of outlining who we are and who Jesus is talking to. So, Christ's guidance is personal, but miracles are impersonal. The impersonal nature of miracles is an essential ingredient because it enables me to control their distribution as I see fit. So as a miracle worker, I need to approach my work impersonally, like without regard to who or what or where it's directed. It has nothing to do with me. But there is a me that Christ has something to do with. The Christ guidance, on the other hand, leads to the highly personal experience of revelation, which later, I believe, it's later, I don't think we've covered this yet, which involves a direct communication with God, we're told. It's a communication between the individual, the unique creation of God with the Creator. And one of the things some will note here is that we are being told we exist. God could not communicate personally to us through revelation if we didn't exist, if we were only a figment of our imagination. And this relates to what the Course describes in the workbook. I think it's lesson 90, where there's a distinction made between self with a small s and self with a capital S. There are two selves. One is illusory that we made up, but one is created by God. So this idea that we only seem to exist and you're not really there, you're just an illusion, is true at the small self level, but not true at the large self level. And if that distinction is not made and that recognition that there are these two levels, we end up with what the Course calls level confusion, that we're applying what's true in one realm of discourse about the ego to another realm of discourse about the eternal. What's true, almost everything true about the eternal is not true about the ego, and almost everything true about the ego is not true about the eternal, or lowercase self, uppercase self, the real versus the illusory. So it's not that everything is an illusion, because that would mean God and heaven are illusions too. If at the ego level, everything may be an illusion, or subject to delusion, but only within that level. So I'm going to give you back the mic.
Okay, anyway, reading that, T1B30M, take up thy cross and follow me, should be interpreted to read, recognize your errors and choose to abandon them by following my guidance. 30N, in parentheses, just seeing where they ended. I've got open parentheses without an ending here. I think that might have been corrected. Okay, so 30N. Tell Bill when he is afraid of possession, he need only remember that error cannot really threaten truth, which always can withstand its assaults. Only the error is really vulnerable. Sorry, there's the closed parentheses on there. The princes of this world are princes only because they are really angels, but they are free to establish their kingdom where they see fit. Do you have an explanation in there? I'm not getting that there, that paragraph. Doug.
Okay. Well, we have two paragraphs here that are both referring to New Testament quotes, which I'll just read here. That'll give us some of the context. Take up your cross and follow me. Comes from Mark 10:21, and I believe the larger context is the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and asks, what must I do to be saved? And Jesus looks upon him and loved him and said unto him, one thing thou lackest, go sell whatsoever thou hast and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven to come. Take up thy cross and follow me. Now, interestingly, the take up thy cross does occur in the 1611 King James Version, doesn't occur in more modern translations, and I haven't looked into the manuscript sources for that, but I conclude from that contemporary scholarship is looking on the take up thy cross and follow me as a later interpolation and not part of the original. But that's where the line comes from, the 1611 English translation of the Gospel of Mark. So Jesus is saying it should be interpreted to read, recognize your errors and choose to abandon them by following my guidance. Now in the next paragraph, tell Bill when he's afraid of possession, and Bill, I don't know a lot about Bill's fear of possession, but it's mentioned frequently enough here that we can know that he had some issues, some fears in relation to that topic. So tell Bill that when he is afraid of possession, he need only remember that error cannot really threaten truth, which always can withstand its assaults. Only the error is really vulnerable. Now in the next line we have the princes of this world. And this comes from the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians. And I'll read that. I've got the one line here in the footnote. Howbeit we speak wisdom amongst them that are perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that come to naught. Now, Paul had and writes about, he has sort of an interest in cosmology. He says elsewhere, I believe it's still in Corinthians, that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but powers and principalities of the air. And he speaks of the prince of this world, and there's some question about just what that meant to him in that time. But it was something supernatural. He wasn't talking about emperors and kings and rulers. And what we're he was talking about spiritual essences or ideas. And here we read, the princes of this world are princes only because they are really angels, but they are free to establish their kingdom where they see fit. And this does seem to link in with Paul's cosmology and those quotes from the New Testament, but just exactly how, just exactly what it's saying, I'm not sure. We're talking about angelic creatures who are at work in the world, which is why they're princes of this world, and they are free to establish their kingdom where they see fit. And just what that means, I don't know. I'm going to give you back the mic.
Maybe it's coming up. I'm going into 30. Oh, thanks, Doug. If you will remember that all princes inherit their power from the Father, the right choice becomes inevitable. The soul is in a state of grace forever. Man's reality is only his soul. Therefore, man is in a state of grace forever. I love that passage. 30p. Atonement undoes all errors in this respect and thus uproots the real source of fear. If you will check back at the reference to uprooting, you will understand it better in this context. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, I think that footnote's going to tell me what the previous reference to uprooting was. That would be T1B22I. And the context there was the, if I recall, the disequilibrium Helen and Bill were experiencing as they began to become aware of what Jesus was teaching them and how utterly contradictory it was to everything they thought they believed at the time. And they felt, and this happens to many people on a spiritual path, as new learning takes place, one feels almost alien, like you've been like a plant that's pulled out of its soil, that your reference points, your understanding of who you are, what you're doing, and what you're about is gone, because you have a newer, larger understanding which reveals the earlier understanding's limitations. So what we're being told here is about essentially our inheritance from our Father in heaven, which is our true nature, our true soul, the self with a capital S, or the soul. The soul is in a state of grace forever because that's how God creates souls. Man's reality is only his soul. Only that which is real is that which God has created, or what we have created with God, with the divine mind within us. Therefore, man is in a state of grace forever. And that would be the level two eternal reality, in contrast to the ego's perception of reality, which is mostly just stuff we made up. That's silly. And then atonement undoes all errors in this respect and thus uproots the real source of fear. The real source of fear, which would be the ego's illusions. If you will check back at the reference to uprooting, you will understand it better in this context. So this is, again, that disequilibrium coming from new learning. And we have 7 minutes left, so we're going to have to start thinking about where we're going to stop this week. But we can go on a little further, I think. And if anyone wants to ask any questions or make any comments, you have time to do it now, in a very few minutes, you won't. Okay? So if you want to pitch in something, stick up your hand. And here's the mic, Deb.
Okay, I'll just give a little bit more time to allow anybody to sift through their minds. If you have any questions that you want to present, raise your hand. And I'm not seeing any hands coming up here or anything on the board, so I'm going to go carry on with 30Q. In parentheses, the whole Q is in parentheses. Tell Bill that whenever God's reassurances are experienced as threat, it is always because man is defending his misplaced and misdirected love and loyalty. That is what projection always involves. Very clear there. 30R. Casting spells merely means affirming error, and error is lack of love. When man projects this onto others, he does imprison them, but only to the extent that he reinforces errors they have already made. This distortion makes them vulnerable to the curse of others, since they have already cursed themselves. The miracle worker can only bless, and this undoes the curse and frees the soul upon prison. And it's very clear right there, too, that projection reinforced, and why it's reinforced in the person that's holding that distortion themselves, that error. Doug, here's the mic.
Well, I find it interesting that we end up with this almost summary comment of what we've been discussing today about the difference between beliefs and reality, and Bill's concern with demons and spells. So casting spells merely means affirming error or reinforcing a belief in the illusory, and an error is a lack of love. When man projects this lack of love onto others, he does imprison them, but only to the extent that he reinforces errors they have already made. We've discussed this at some length today. This distortion, the error they've already made, makes them vulnerable to the curse of others, since they have essentially already cursed themselves. The miracle worker can only bless, and this undoes the curse and frees the soul from prison. And we remember that undoing and atonement has been defined as undoing. And the curse is simply a misperception coming from a lack of love, the solution being love and forgiveness. Wow. We are getting to... we can get these last three little paragraphs done. I think that's going to be our stopping point, Deborah. That's a good break point.
Okay, 30S, parentheses, tell Bill that his ship about, in parentheses, rivet, should be noted. That was his slip, not ship. I'll start it again. In parentheses, tell Bill that his slip about, in parentheses, rivet, should be noted. Some slips reach consciousness from the un-Christ-controlled subconscious and betray a lack of love, close parentheses. But others, in parentheses, slips, come from the superconscious, which is in communication with God, and which can also break into consciousness. His slip, in parentheses, rivet, was an expression of a soul gaining enough strength to request freedom from prison. It will ultimately demand it. That's the end of the three paragraphs, isn't it? 1, 2, 3. It is. So, Doug, here's the mic.
Well, that's an interesting little discussion. It refers to a typo Bill had made, or a Freudian slip, in confusing river with rivet. And Jesus is explaining to Bill here that this one was actually coming from his superconscious, reflecting the expression of a soul gaining enough strength to request freedom from prison. It's a bit of a pat on the back to Bill. So I'm going to wind up here today and thank you all for your presence and attention and comments. And I think I have this one recorded, so if you've missed any part of it and want to catch it, it'll be on the website, I think, fairly soon. Also, I was able to get 90 minutes of the February 28th broadcast, which Ruby actually had recorded that one, and my recording didn't work. And there was several people had requested that one, which we didn't have, but it's now up on the website. And that's at www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74. And we're just about out of time here. We've learned a lot about asking Jesus, divine communication, Christ guidance, how it works. It's been a fascinating little time. Deborah, here's the mic for your goodbyes.
And my gratitudes. Thanks, everybody who's joined in here and all radio participants as well. And Ruby, I also want to give my gratitude to you, extend it, because that was a very important missing week. And we were going to pull together to do it over again. But we don't, that is not necessary now. So thanks very much. And thanks very much, Doug. Again, thank you for doing all this work and having it available for us all. So it's to be continued. And as I'm leaving the mic, I just want to reinforce the soul is in a state of grace forever. Man's reality is only his soul. Therefore, man is in a state of grace forever. We're in grace forever. Bye, everyone. Thanks again.